$155 million wonderland. As if by magic, 1,216 acres of wasteland have been transformed into the most stupendous exposition the world has ever known.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness the most excitingly different new concept in the history of television.
So you see, folks, all of you who are living in the year 2000 are fortunate.
I think it was back in 1944, wasn't it, Mother?
That's the most remarkable thing I've ever seen.
Pete, so how was your weekend? How was Mother's Day?
Mother's Day was really good. We went to the Reading Phillies.
Oh, yeah.
And they were fighting the God, this is because I'm so used to the fighting Phils. No, they were the hot dogs. They're Reading hot dogs that day. Cause sometimes they change their name.
They do, and they do the Berks pork, the Berkshire pork products. They have a bacon hat, and yeah, they do all. It's minor league baseball, yeah. They all sorts of fun.
Yeah, and they were playing the Timberwolves.
The Timberwolves, okay.
Yeah, and we got rained out, but there was a buffet.
Ah, bummer.
And we got to hang out, and the kids had a blast because they were just really happy to go somewhere, and they only filled it to half capacity, so there was a ton of room.
The kids love that. Were you guys moving closer and stuff?
Oh, yeah, no, we could sit wherever we wanted. They were like, just stay in this section. We don't care. And it's like, what?
The Phillies in the 90s. Yeah, the big league team was bad enough. We used to go. But actually, the Reading Phillies, because I grew up, we used to always go to them when I was a kid. But I'm actually banned from the stadium.
Okay. All right. What did you do? Did you like run naked across the field or something?
I wasn't naked, but yeah. So like kind of college.
So you legit ran across the field.
Oh yeah. Like, yeah.
That totally happened.
The Reading Phillies. Yeah. So we went up, it was me and a couple buddies. Mm-hmm. We were like 19. The one friend that was driving, he didn't, it was like his dad's car. We were under, he narked out at the last second. We were going to tailgate. We didn't. So we went into this Reading Phillies game at age 19, sober. And we got there and we were like, this, something's wrong about this. So you can eat as many hot dogs as you want, but I don't know. It wasn't quite fun enough. You try to recreate the magic when you were a kid, because I used to love going there when I was a kid. Someone started lobbing the bet around, like, someone should run across the field. Let's get some excitement here. And I took them on it. And so we created this elaborate plan where I was to go to the right field, to the outfield, and during whatever out was the first out to the second out, because that's usually when the players stretch it out, and I was going to then jump in down into the bullpen, which is on the right field wall, and then I was going to run across the field. I did this. It was an incredible rush. Half the stadium was cheering, half was booing. The left fielder called me a... or an effing D-bag, I guess I should say, for the edit. Yeah, so the left fielder calls me an effing D-bag. I didn't know what to do with my hands. So, and Pete, you'll get a kick out of this, just maybe knowing my personal politics, but okay. I throw up the Nixon peace singles, you know, the peace hands,
what?
Like when he
Why?
Was getting on the plane. I don't know. I didn't know what to do with my hands. And, you know, I was 19. We were in,
like,
you know.
Oh, they're in positions of power.
Bush,
they must be Republican.
Bush had us. Yeah, yeah. There was the wars, and I was just trying to be an advocate for peace while disrupting the peace. I figured it would just cancel out. The cops didn't see it that way, though, because.
I don't think cops see anything.
Our plan was my one friend was going to stand up during this to, like, you know, go get a soda or something. And he and it worked.
Oh, you're so dumb. Yes.
And so I go crashing.
I was gonna get me a soda water.
Soda
and go
water,
sit on the roof.
And I come crashing into the left field, the foul territory, the left field line wall. And I still remember the sound because there was like a. You know, minor league baseball, they have the advertisements, and they're like sometimes just like big license plates, like it's a medal, and they're just pinned on the wall. So my knees go slamming into that. I still remember how that hurt. But I climb up this small wall, and I go up to this is where we were sitting. So my friends like set the pick because we had the area security guard. And the one friend, Mike, what's up, if you're listening, sets this beautiful pick for me, just like in our basketball. And so I'm able to make it past him. I get to this. there's a dining area. I jump up on the picnic tables and then run up this little like thing to get on this brick wall, which I then scaled up in this corner. And it, what I didn't realize when I got to the top of this brick wall, no one could get to me. The cops, they were all the security, they had gathered 3, 4, 5 of them down in this little corner. And I'm up top and I didn't account for it with being a 60-foot drop to the outside of the stadium. And so I was stuck and I was stuck and I wish, because in retrospect, so I had to come down, right? Swallow my pride and come down. As they're walking me to their little like cop office in the stadium, every section, you know, when you enter into the stadium, there's the sections, the little hallways so you can get in. And they all have a security guard to check your ticket. Well, this is the biggest thing that happened at a Reading Phillies game that they could remember. So they're all, I'm creating this entourage of law enforcement or mall cops, whatever these guys are.
We got Son of Sam, everybody. Don't worry.
Yeah, they put me in the office. They start interrogating me. But, I mean, they had good nature.
What did you do this time, Manson?
No, they definitely had a good sense of humor about it. I did technically, yeah, I was arrested. Sorry, Mom. but this is the catch. I had to go up to Reading, and the judge, he threw my case out because I don't even remember how it happened, but he laughed. He thought it was funny. I told him it was a bet. I told him we were sober, and he believed it all. I told him I was going to Penn State. He was a Penn Stater, and then we started talking about, like, 1960s football, which I was able to talk about because I grew up watching NFL films. So
sports nerd. Like, that's what got you into history.
And so this guy, I became friends with this judge, kind of, in fast friends in 5 minutes.
But are you still banned?
Technically, yeah, because that had nothing to, so the stadium told me I'm not welcome ever again. So I don't know. I've contemplated doing, you know, the Groucho Marx, the sunglasses with the mustache, could go in long hair, beard. I don't know how they would uphold this, but yes, in the eyes of the law, I was innocent. The case was thrown out, justice was served, and but in the eyes of the Reading Phillies, I don't know. Did you see wanted posters there? It might still be a thing. This was like 15 years ago, so I don't know how much action
they were for
there.
That the soda jerk that rides the ostrich with his hot dogs. Which is a real thing. That's a real thing. And
I love minor league
baseball. It
doesn't make
any sense at all. I was like, what does any of this mean?
It's a carnival that has a sporting event also. That's what a minor league baseball is.
Yeah, and like one of them might end up being Ryan Howard, you know? Like that's,
yeah, it's you're like investing in the future. I remember going to a Delaware Blue Rocks game when I was a kid and Carlos Beltran was there. And he's like a... He's a manager right now for, like, the Yankees, but he's a Hall of Fame player, and, like, you could tell. It was just amazing to watch him when he was younger. So, yeah, love minor league baseball. Happy Mother's Day to the moms, even mine, who I gave a heart attack, I'm sure, when she found out about that incident. But, yeah, love you, Mom, and love all the moms.
Yes, happy belated Mother's Day.
Katie, my sister-in-law, new mom, happy Mother's Day, and Pete.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I will pass that on to my wife. And hi, everybody. Karen, welcome to Guerrilla Film History Now. I'm Pete.
And I'm Mark.
And this is a show where one film nerd bails out another film nerd out of county prison.
Solidarity.
So do you have anything to plug this week, Mark?
Yeah, I'll just say, check me out on my personal Instagram. I'm Mark Rubendahl. It's very simple. I just post art, poem, poetry, and musings, rants, all that kind of thing. And check us out at Right Brain Studios on Instagram and Twitter. We actually just jumped on TikTok now, too. So you can check us out on those platforms. That's I'm working on that Bard project, with Right Brain.
My buddy nice. Kevin.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you'll be able to find a new piece for me this week on dorkdaily.com.
Nice.
I'm your gamer dad.
I love that.
This week I am not but gaming with my kids, though. This time I'm solo. I am on the shores of Rayclast in Path of Exile this week. It's free-to-play, asymmetric action, RPG, like Diablo 2. Diablo 2 Resurrected is going to be coming out soon. Path of Exile 2 is going to be coming out soon. So I thought it would be fun to go and... back to something I haven't really had a chance to play in a very long time, and it's very gory, it's very dark, very grimdark, very 80s, 80s fantasy.
Perfect for today.
No, it feels like I should have Slayer on in the background sometimes. It's great. But today we're going to be talking actually a lot about really the 1980s is really going to be the focus. We came out of the new wave, end of the 1970s and into the early 1980s. And we kind of hinted to it last week when we talked about Jaws and we talked about Star Wars briefly. But corporate guys see that and go, oh, wait a second. We can like genre-fy stuff. We can make franchises. But we wanted to try to dive in a little bit more into Star Wars in the beginning just to give
that's
you
what
a basis
got it all
of
started.
Like, yeah, like to give you an idea of like what these guys were, and they were men looking for.
Well, and we'll get like to George Lucas's wife, though, who probably saved the entire thing.
That was 100% her. There would not have been an episode four if it wasn't for her. But I mean, I'm not saying that like, oh, look at us, it was guys. It was like literally like no one else was allowed in the room. Luckily, that is changing now.
Yes.
It needs to change quicker. It's changing.
We wish
now.
It would have before it didn't.
Yeah, it
so,
should have
yeah.
been 20 years ago, which was not when the 80s were. The 80s were 40 years ago at this point.
Right.
drill that into your old dementia-ridden head.
Sometimes it's like, oh, yeah.
Oh, wait a second. 30s are old.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, we were born tail end of the 80s.
I was born 88.
Yeah, same.
I was January 88, so technically I'm older than you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
January 10th.
All right, so you beat me by, I'm February 7th, so.
Yeah, I beat you by 3 weeks.
Wow, man. All right. Well, 3 weeks, I actually feel even smaller than you now. but I got an extra 3 weeks
for everyone
to
at
grow.
Home, I am a giant.
Pete is very large, very broad shoulders.
Yeah, there's
but very sweet.
But Big Bird, Shaq, and Calvin Harris are all taller than me.
And you were saying how Chewbacca was—he's your co-pilot, right? So
yeah,
you got two
co-pilot.
Big lumbering figures in the cockpit.
I do identify a lot with Han Solo. I would love to actually cosplay as Han Solo one day, but I wouldn't be able to like do it right because I'd be bigger than whoever Chewie was. So I'd have to be Chewie, which kind of sucks because I can't do the voice.
Well, maybe that opens up Han for me then.
That's as close as I can get. But yeah, let's talk about Star Wars.
Yeah, we breached it a little bit last week, and we were talking about with Jaws, but the thing, it's interesting, this new wave energy, they were betrayed by their own successes and some of their own failures as a collective. But in 75 when Jaws comes out and then 77 when Star Wars, the studios who had relinquished power for the decade past for a number of reasons, but that's why this American New Wave was able to slide in this kind of, it's like an 8 year span. In reality, it's kind of goes like 15 if you want to widen it out for analysis. Yeah, it's this 8 year period, Jaws comes out, Star Wars, and the studios understand, oh, okay, these guys can make big money, and the ones that we can work with, we can make partnerships with, like franchises.
Yeah, and if they form like independent film companies, for example, DreamWorks or Lucasfilm or something,
Lucasfilms.
They can always become a subsidiary of a larger corporation like Viacom, who also happens to own all these other studios. So, like, what ends up happening is kind of this conglomeration and corporatization of film at a much more aggressive rate than before. Like, you got to remember, we're coming into the 90s. Like, the 90s was when, it was like late 90s when Microsoft got broken up, right? So, like, we're getting towards, this kind of apex of mega corporations, like, kind of make monopolies again.
As far as film, this, again, if you remember, this isn't really new. We talked about in one of our earlier episodes about how, like, Edison in the trust, right? They had this firm that would operate as a monopoly, and they were trying to integrate as many aspects, pretty much all of them, of the filmmaking, the process, the shooting, the actors, the actresses, down to the distribution into the actual projector. So, that's the model they would love, and obviously it gets clawed back over time. But yeah, the 80s sees this is kind of a negotiation between the talent on screen and the people financing it. And the 80s sees the finance guys win big.
Yeah, but it also gives these artists, I think, the illusion. And I do say illusion of getting a fair shake because there's so much money on the table.
The big chance.
Yeah, and it's not just the big chance, though. I mean, they're getting bigger numbers than they would have, you know.
True.
30,
oh, very,
years ago.
Yeah.
Even 10 years ago, they're getting bigger numbers. And if you're willing to play ball, you're able to get gigantic budgets for stuff. And then, you get those back-end residuals. You're able to take that and fund your passion projects.
And then you have a relationship with these studios.
Yeah, but like at the same time, what you end up getting is this situation where there's actually hundreds of millions of dollars on the table, more than what you originally anticipated. So now all of a sudden that paycheck of like a few million, now it feels like you got like the equivalent of like $50,000 or $60,000. Like that's what it feels like, because like really the amount changed, but the percentage actually stayed the same or got worse.
Well, and that was part of Lucas's genius is at the outset of this, is he saw some of the technology, it was too expensive to use, so he started his own. They forged their own path with ILM and sound design, and I mean, it's a sound library they started on Star Wars, and it's still in use today. It's incredible. George Lucas also, he had ancillary rights on Star Wars, so he was able to actually make more money off of like the spin-offs and some of the merch and stuff than he was the films.
Yeah, now for those at home who might not know what ancillary means, because we do actually have an international audience at this point. Guten Tag to our German
Guten
family.
Tag.
Yeah, so just to give a little quick shout out to one of the countries, and we'll try to do that as much as we can as we continue. But yeah, what does that mean, ancillary?
So the film as itself is a property, right? The ancillary is everything like beyond that, which is what we're talking. I think the word you mentioned is like toyetics, right? So that's where like this stuff comes in.
When we were discussing the episode, I told him about toyetics, which is that's another term we can get into in a minute.
But yeah, we're also thinking TV shows. I mean, the famous holiday special. I mean, I'm pretty sure Lucas got a huge chunk of that money because that was part of his deal. And now I think he conceived this whole thing as a series, and he had the vision, if not at first, to see it very early on as being in a franchise and entity. And I mean, I don't think he could have seen where it went today, but like he understood the money and the hoopla around this film and this excitement and the technology, which looked like magic on the screen. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you got to remember, like, the summer before this was French Connection. You know, like, it was actually, like, really hard-hitting.
French Connection too, yeah.
Yeah, like, it was really tough movies. It was really hard-hitting. It was like, you know, this is reality. It was very much the height of the new wave. So there comes this movie where it's actually not that dark, and it's got a good message, and it's a clear fantasy story, and it's got all this kind of Americana-ish stuff in it, like Flash Gordon. It harkens back to 50s sci-fi, to a simpler time.
Yeah, it's kind of a Western because you have like the black hats versus the white hats. Exactly. I mean, it is. It's yeah. For kids, it's for adults too.
Yeah, but it's really a family easy enough film. For kids. So there wasn't actually people making any films for that market. As far as they were concerned, they were kind of throwaway films. Like these people brought their family to the movies so that it was for the kids, and they just sat there and just like rolled their eyes or just kind of like weren't really a part of it. And there was occasionally those blips of people like Walt Disney through the years who saw like, no, this is a family unit, and tried to make it like for the entire family. Lucas is one of those people. That's why the toys were so important and all those ancillary rights were so important, because it wasn't just about those movies. It was about the world that these kids could escape to in the midst of like all of this news coverage, you know? Like,
in which, of course, the parents would have to buy for. And
yeah, but they would be willing to create that blanket of security for their kid, that blanket of illusion for their child, and it kind of gave them that Hollywood movie magic again.
The trick with Star Wars is that it gave adults that feeling too.
Yeah,
and it's hard for us to sit here now and picture what it was like. I mean, we grew up more or less with like these technologies that would have melted brains in 1977, but for what it was in 1977, it's remarkable what you see on screen. We talked about it a little bit with Ridley Scott and Alien.
Still look good.
It's incredible. And yeah, Ridley Scott, he also with Alien, they were pulling from Kubrick, of course, with 2001. But these movies, they allow adults to feel that sweeping away, that childhood imagination. And that, I mean, that is the one thing that Star Wars, because it offers something almost of like a religious awakening with the Force. And you have all these good and evil.
Yes, it's very spiritual.
And, but it's also like political, especially with like the prequels and stuff.
I mean, he literally uses the word stormtroopers in it, which is harkening back to World War II Nazis.
Yes. And some of it is very broad, and some of it is very subtle. I mean, he's pulling from all sorts of ancient philosophies and mysticism.
Yeah, but he's pulling from Lord of the Rings as well. I mean, the idea of like, technology versus nature, where the Imperial Army is very much all about technology. The Rebel Alliance seems to have almost like this spiritual druidic sense about them, where they're on Yavin 4 with the temple, and they have the Jedi on their side and the Force on their side, and it's this kind of amorphous nature magic of the universe. Like, that very much feels like an ancient story. I mean,
the Romans would have persecuted you for. Yeah.
Yeah, or like the idea of finding the weapon and like the whole Joseph Campbell Hero of a Thousand Faces. That becomes very popular during this period because of Lucas blatantly using it to outline his entire trilogy. I mean, he's also drawing from Kurosawa.
Huge. John Ford.
What was it, Golden Fortress?
Yeah, Hidden Fortress. Where you get... That's where it's these two bumbling thieves who tell the story.
The bumbling thieves are C-3PO and R2-D2.
Right, because George Lucas originally conceived it as like, and the movies kind of turn out that way, but they are like kind of your perspective. They're the ones who are like peering in on this.
Obi-Wan Kenobi was originally written for Toshiro Mifune as well.
Oh, that would have been so great.
I think that would have been weird. The film nerd in me goes, yeah, that would be cool to see, but I feel like...
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to imagine anyone. And he didn't even like the film, right? He had no idea the words he was saying.
Wizard. I mean, I'm used to doing Shakespeare. I feel like I'm a washed-up has-been. Like, for him, it was his Plan 9 from outer space, and he was Bela Lugosi, just like, oh, God. He didn't realize he was going to be entering into this brand-new world of Comic-Cons.
Yeah, and I mean, you got to think the same thing. Did Christopher Lee know he was going to be CGI'd 40 years later, or... Christopher Lee? Peter
O'Toole.
We're reaching because it's not O'Toole. It's the
Peter
guy who looks,
Sellers.
No.
Peter Wellers.
Walter Peter Kellers. Payton.
Tom Brady. Steven.
Oh, Tom Brady. Yeah, now my mind's scrambling back to the 04 Super Bowl. Focus. So Indiana Jones in 1981 it's Spielberg and Lucas, and they kind of, the way I see it at least, they do the math with Jaws and Star Wars, and then they see what they had successful, and they looked at it and said, okay, let's get ourselves a series for the 80s here, and let's almost manufacture it backwards. And that's what they did. And it's kind of what Lucas did with Star Wars, because you take all these disparate pop culture references, some of them half-remembered, some of them mostly forgotten. Like you were saying with the Flash Gordon stuff, I mean, Spielberg and Lucas for Indiana Jones were pulling from all sorts of old dime store novels and old Western heroes and just things you wouldn't come across, but it became this like magical thing, right? Because and I mean, there's some problems with, I mean, if you read Edward Said, the great Palestinian, he wrote the book on Orientalism and uses Indiana Jones as a prime example. But what it does is you transplant the action into somewhere, say, in the Middle East, and it becomes instantly like magical or foreign or exotic.
Yeah, and it kind of has that colonialist edge to it.
Yeah, which, and I mean, him being an archaeologist, right, we got to get these things into the museum. I mean, those strains are there, but that's just us talking.
That belongs in a museum. That belongs with its people. Give it back to the tribe. It belongs with them. They've had it for 1,000 years. They've guarded it with pointy sticks the whole time. You came in with a revolver and a whip. Fuck off.
Right. Yeah.
I work in Oxford. Yeah, I work in Wildpot. Go to hell.
Yeah. Who the fuck cares about an Oxford? What's that matter? And think about the culture clash of that. I mean, you get the great scene with in the market square where Indiana Jones, he just pulls out the revolver and shoots the guy who does this elaborate choreographed dance, and he just kills him.
And it was because like Harrison Ford was doing a joke and the guy played along, but Steven Spielberg thought that was so funny. And then the guy, I think the guy stormed off the set or something. Like, honestly, I think that's what happened.
It had to be so frustrating. I also heard it had to do with, didn't Harrison Ford have like dysentery for the whole shoot? And so I think he was supposed to do some fight scene, and he had this, the runs that day, and they were just like, let's do the gun take where I don't have to move. But yeah, it's so again, that's a little bit of my editorial to bring a little of the politosphere in. But if you look at these movies, how they were pretty much seen by everyone in 1981, yeah, you have this – it doesn't have the same magical element of Star Wars, but you do get ancient magic unleashed in the end that, you know, melts faces and all this. So it adds supernatural with this real worn-in feel, right? Pete, we've talked about how the look of the early the Star Wars. That yeah, everything's dusty, rusty, you know, shaggy hair. It's these people are, they feel real. And this is, you know, Lucas and these guys pulling from Italian neorealism where they're using, you know, non-professional actors. You want these people to look like this is where they live. They live on Dagobah or they live on Tatooine. No one lives on Dagobah, right? Just Yoda?
yeah, Dagobah is actually a...
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I
But that's the one of the elements that like these corporate guys start looking at for, well, what's a good script when we're speccing scripts, right? Because they're kind of start moneyballing movies at this point.
Oh.
There's so much money on the table, and there's so much more potential for money.
You start seeing these things as formulas.
Yeah, just like they did like the whole Moneyball movie with Brad Pitt. Like, if you watch that movie and just imagine him talking about scripts, like, that's kind of what it is. It's like, well, it has these elements and it has this thing. And if we can get this person who is in those kinds of movies and that's their thing, then we can make this much money on it.
Yeah, you hope to pigeonhole. I mean, Harrison Ford had a great career outside of these movies, but if you just said he was Indiana Jones and Han Solo, he could have quit with those six films and been whatever, yeah, been one of the Hollywood icons.
Yeah, but then he would have never had that great scene with Gary Oldman where he's just, get off my plane.
That is a great film. And yeah, Harrison Ford definitely... His like 90s thriller phase was fantastic, and I'm sure
he did a great job.
Yeah, and he still might be due for one of these Liam Neeson taken old man angry, like they might roll Harrison Ford out for one of those. my man is he's still out there flying planes, right?
Yeah,
did that crash a couple years ago.
Well, Hemingway beat his own head out of a beat himself out of a plane with his own head. I want to see what it's like. Quick. Ally McBeal, get me the whiskey. I don't like when you call me that, Harrison.
There's this thing called cocaine.
Psychosis.
A lot of people were doing this cocaine thing in the 80s.
La cocaina.
Yeah, it's also, I won't get into it, but there's also, yes, colonial project at hand there if you want to read about the...
we could have a whole bonus episode scandal. Just about you know, Reagan and Iran-Contra and all that kind of stuff. But like, I mean, that is also kind of the aesthetic of a lot of the action movies that come out during this period.
Absolutely.
It feels very much like they eat bald eagles for breakfast.
Sure, yeah.
Like by the time you get to Rambo 3, it's like he's got rocket arrows. Like, what? We're just in a video game. They're sitting there. They're
In Rocky 3, he's got a robot.
Rambo 2, I'm like, it's First Blood. Part two, Rambo. I think that's the whole title.
Makes no sense.
Yeah, and Rambo, First Blood, Part Two. Yes, and then it's Rambo 3. That's what it is. It goes, it goes First Blood. I can do this, everyone. It goes First Blood, Rambo, First Blood, Part Two, Rambo 3, Rambo, Last Blood. We did
okay,
it,
and that was the recent one. Okay. Yeah, Pete! This is for the Mujahideen. I'm pretty sure that's
I am a river to my people.
Rambo is just about like, what if we didn't process any of the trauma from Vietnam and just like went back in and got it right this time because we sent the right people.
The way you deal with trauma is you just blow their brains out the way they did your buddy.
Right. But yeah, so the point is with those movies, you think of Top Gun. We have some, there's like militarism that is very much on display.
Aliens.
And this is kind of.
We take a new film like Alien, which is very much about like anti-corporate whatever, and it turns into Aliens, which is a Vietnam War movie in space where it's like, you know what, it's not really the corporation, or the military. It's really like just these people in power in these particular situations. And if there were different people like so-and-so here, Captain America, everything would be different. And like, it's kind of like the message of the Falcon Winter Soldier thing where it's like, oh yeah, it's the super serum. It's like, no, it's the person. But like, if it's the person, then maybe that's not the right system. If it's the person, but that's never what anyone talks about in these movies. They just go, oh yeah, no, like if everyone would have just been allowed to do their quote unquote job, everything would have been fine.
Bravado is, I mean, Reagan kind of, yeah, he felt he had that mandate to save this country from the ills of communism or whatever, and how that manifested culturally. And you got to remember, Reagan is from Hollywood. He understood very well how the power structure works. Jay Hoberman's got his great book, Make My Day, that looks at some of this Reagan and the political influence on the film industry. But yeah, you got to keep that in mind with these movies. Interestingly enough, Top Gun ended up being the movie so popular. I mean, I think of it, that movie just has everything. It's got young Tom Cruise. It's got, you know, fighter pilots. It had the U.S. military, you know, helping fund it. And you get a great director. It's slam bang. I mean, that movie was so great. Everyone wanted to see it that it broke the model for rentals, because like VHS tapes up until 86 would have been like $90 to buy one for your home. And so this is where rentals start coming in, because they get you with late fees and all this stuff, and they can start to afford having a library of these expensive VHSs. But with Top Gun, they like cut the price down to 30 from 90, and now it's a whole new world of accessibility. And Top Gun being, it's like the point of, it's the breakthrough of what, of bringing movies to the home.
That's kind of like what The Matrix was in 99 for DVDs. Like that
it's the perfect DVD comparison, Pete.
Like when that came out on DVD and it had all those special features, it was like, I think people forgot like what a crazy deal that was to get like a DVD player and have The Matrix DVD. And it felt like The Matrix was going to come out of that disc, because there's,
you've arrived in the future.
Yeah, it felt amazing. Like it was that level back then with Top Gun. And Top Gun also feels like something that could have been a franchise, but they just didn't really, where they weren't able to like capitalize upon it. But there's also these people that also, because of the VHS thing, as it gets cheaper, you start getting like these rehashes of older things. Let's turn these into franchises.
Red Dawn, Commando. I mean, these aren't exactly.
Well, no, I think those were big, like major motion pictures at the time. But what I'm talking about is like Jaws 3D.
Oh, okay. Yeah, where we,
we start getting like this VHS revolution.
Smokey
of, like,
and the Bandit 3.
Yeah, part 3. Yeah.
Where you're like, where was 2? I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah, or it's like Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Part whatever, and it's like, because it's going to be for VHS.
It's coming straight out.
Straight to video. We don't even need to wait for the theatrical release anymore. And you start getting more and more of these, like, rehashes and sequels, particularly like in horror.
Yes, horror. I mean, famously, in the 80s, it had a field day. And like the Nightmare on Elm Street, there's so many of them. I couldn't even tell you, but we're definitely
Friday the 13th.
Yeah, Friday. Yeah, sorry.
That too. And that's what I'm saying.
Just you have the crossovers. Yeah, you have
Children of the Corn.
Halloween, which started out as like a new wave independent film, and somehow by John Carpenter, became. Somehow becomes this huge series, and you know,
much to the chagrin of Carpenter.
And that's probably why he stepped away.
For people who don't know what chagrin is, being pissed.
Yeah, it's an artistic way to say never again. But yeah, if you didn't mention like Wes Craven, you know, he made a career. He's kind of like a horror Roger Corman or something. He's like, I don't know if you call him an auteur, but he's kind of like this.
He's not a schlock guy.
Avuncular figure.
He's not schlock.
Like, and, well,
I mean, he kind of had that reputation though. At the time, I think.
But because we're talking low budgets. I mean, it's interesting we talked about minor league baseball, because I think you had made the point to me over the phone before that this is like what starts happening, because you can studios can afford with these straight to VHSs as its own money model. Now you could start giving a kid a shot. Here, direct this movie, see how it goes. Or, I mean, Johnny Depp's in Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, you can find gems in these low budget, even if they're the schlockier ones.
Yeah, or the fifth in this series. George Clooney's first movie is one of the Attack of the Killer Tomato movies.
Oh, okay. Wow. Man. And actually, that just DiCaprio was in like one like the third entry in one of those horror, not Gremlins, but something like that, like a creature film. And yeah, I'm sure the list could go on, but it
actually,
it's a great
believe
way
it or not, like Chris Hemsworth was the big one of the bigger people in Cabin in the Woods, but he had actually shot that film and it was in the can before Thor came out. But Thor became such a big thing before that movie was able to actually ship out because they were having like trouble with the distribution or they weren't sure what to do with it. And then all of a sudden he blew up and they're like, oh, well, Thor's in this movie.
Yeah.
And then they put it out there and it was like it became this cult hit. But
yeah, people love that movie.
He technically did that movie first. That's still kind of a tradition in a weird way.
Yeah, where you can break. Yeah, that's a great point. The 80s, a lot of, and I'm one of them. I kind of think the look of a lot of those films, like with that washout video VHS look, it's all putting to me. And the fact that all these franchises, it just felt like an IP churn, which honestly,
like, I don't feel like
isn't
John Carpenter's
new.
Movies felt like that though. Like, no, look at The Thing, for example. For me, like, I think that's the pinnacle of like all his stuff. Now at the time it bombed, and a lot of it had to do with the release window. It came out like a week or two after E.T. So
wow,
yeah, bad timing.
How unfortunate.
Yeah, not the best timing.
One of the five biggest movies ever.
And also, it was really like a commentary on the AIDS epidemic. And
yeah, that okay.
Like the idea that one cell of this creature can turn and attack another cell and then they start replicating, that it literally was like that.
I remember talking about this with you at the Evil grocery store we used to work for, and it was when the Hateful Eight trailer came out because someone had done the Thing cut on it,
yes,
the trailer cut, and we were talking about how like those movies being similar in ways we hadn't necessarily realized at first, and then you laid on that Thing being like a public, like a health crisis analysis.
Yeah.
It blew my mind. So every time I hear about that movie, that comes to mind. And that's the kind of analysis that'll change the way you look at a film. And that's, I mean, to jump back a couple episodes, that's why you need these conversations. You'll learn just from someone else's perspective. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really great. But that movie, it has like a really like romanticized cult following now. And a lot of his films do now, but like they live. A lot of them weren't like super successful at the time. Like they gained an audience later on in like the VHS DVD
and
market.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of those horror things, and we can do a whole episode on body horror and all that stuff. And maybe we should.
The Fly.
Like, yeah. The Fly. We could go to
the Cronenberg stuff.
Videodrome. Yeah. Like And I think a lot of originality was there, but like those movies weren't super popular in terms of like the movie going public. I think we look back on the 80s with the cyberpunk kind of stuff and cyber synthwave stuff and or Stranger Things and think like, oh, that's how it was, where you look at Fright Night and go like, oh wow. But a lot of it was like Rambo 3 or Beverly Hills Cop Part 2. Like a lot of the major movies at the time were more like that. Like a lot of the cartoons of the 90s comment on like this time in the 80s of all this franchising. But there were guys, auteurs within the drama space, within like the Academy realm, that were doing great work. Like the height of like Charlie Sheen's professional careers with Oliver Stone, with Platoon and Wall Street.
Yeah, excellent point. Because in Oliver Stone, I mean, people give him a lot of shit. I know he's got some really confusing and weird politics. But if you go back to his 80s work, and I mean, I love The Doors, which is an early 90s.
I think that's
my favorite
biopic.
But
I think that's fantastic.
It's good. Yeah, I stand the Oliver Stone Doors movie. But
really like it too. I really do. I think Val Kilmer does a fantastic job being Jim Morrison.
It's incredible. And it was supposed to be Tom Cruise, I heard. And that would have been awful. So Val Kilmer saved the day.
No, Val Kilmer was way better.
Way better. But yeah, you were Charlie Sheen in Platoon, who has Johnny Depp, is like the silent second lead in that movie.
I totally forgot he's in that movie.
And I think the story was he was supposed to be the lead, but they thought he looked too young. Yeah. And I think it was ironic because I think he was a couple years older than Sheen. But I mean, Sheen obviously had the legacy of his.
Drugs at that point.
I think the Sheen thing was strictly, it was like his dad was Apocalypse Now. Like we have, like that we comes built Sheen. In. Yeah. And like, why not just roll with that?
I think and Martin that movie's Sheen actually great. Like warned Charlie not to do that movie because that was going to like make him bad. And like, I think that's the movie that like really started him on that downward
Martin
spiral.
Martin Sheen, I don't know if we mentioned, he had a heart attack on the set of Apocalypse Now because they were shooting, it was just such torturous conditions. He was only like 35 or something. He was very young, and in the production, they like lied about it because they didn't want to tell the studio they had to stall anymore. Platoon is great. Oliver Stone, also he wrote Scarface, I believe, which is interesting because that's one of those uber 80s movies where you have the bad, like, whiny 80s, not whiny 80s song, but that, like, kind of guitar. Oh, yeah. And the montage and the tiger.
Michael
and Mann it's just,
kind of vibe that ever.
Yeah, every collar's popped. Every red is the reddest you've ever seen. And
no one's wearing a black suit.
Yeah.
And if they are, it's
the Undertaker.
Yeah. It's like their death scene. Like that. I think that was his farewell to cocaine.
Oliver Stone.
Yeah, I think, the Scarface script was his farewell to cocaine, just like The Shining was Stephen King's farewell to alcohol.
Like,
they both did the same thing around the same time. Like within, like, 10 years of each other, they were, like, kind of doing the same kind of thing where they were like, oh, I'm at this precipice of change. Either I'm going to get sober and, you know, or I'm not. And the way that, like, part of their process of, like, saying goodbye to their stuff was, like, this terrible story of, like, what happened to someone who basically indulged in the other direction. So it, like, gave them, like, this way to kind of have that fantasy. I think that's why Oliver Stone got so much harder on yuppie culture. When he got sober, because he realized a lot of it was just about, they just wanted to have, like, lunches with a bunch of crazy alcohol and cocaine. Like that's really what the whole thing was. It was just about the lifestyle of doing that. And if that's the point, then why do it? You're just killing people for no reason. You're like destroying families just to, so you can have another wet pile of cocaine, you bastard. Like, that's why he got like that.
Yeah, and I mean, it is the drug of capitalism because it knows no end. It's like a profit motive. There's no amount that's, you know, too much. It's just, how do we get more? Who are we calling? We got to get more.
Well, I think you can OD on it, can't you? I don't know. I've never done
cocaine. Not my drug of choice for sure. Mary Jane, the only.
You and Tom Petty.
Last chance for Mary Jane. I love that song. Oliver Stone, he's one of these guys because he was in Vietnam, right? So he had actual perspective on the war. So when he writes Platoon, I mean, that movie was able to kind of break through. It was a phenomenon, as I understand it. And it was big at the Oscars. Oliver Stone's one of these guys. He entered into like New York film schools as because he went to film school, and so he wanted to give back and be a teacher. And Scorsese does this too in the 80s. Nicholas Ray, who made like Rebel Without a Cause, and just those three names I want to mention because we talk about the American New Wave guys having gone to film school, right? And they're being beneficiaries of this Cahiers du Cinéma, this auteur, and Pauline Kael and Ebert with the criticism.
Cassavetes.
And so Cassavetes, who's facilitating all of this great stuff with great music too. And so it's this wide array. And by the time we get to the 80s, these guys who want to give back, your Scorsese's, Spielberg's, Nicholas Ray's, they have tutor this younger crop. Jim Jarmusch, who is a favorite filmmaker of mine. I have his Patterson poster on my wall right here. It's a great Adam Driver film from 2016. But he came up, Nicholas Ray was teaching, and he was like old, if you know Nick Ray. He had like an eye patch. He's crazy, just character, drunk guy, crazy white hair, which Jim Jarmusch, he also sports the crazy white hair. But total New York scene guy. Mystery Train is a movie by him. It takes a look at.
Oh, I know.
Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm an Elvis guy. So that movie hits. But yeah, it's about a bunch of people go down to Memphis to look at like the Elvis and all those rockabilly guys and just take it in. My favorite segment is it's this I believe a Korean couple and they don't speak any English, but they love Elvis and they're dressed in like. You know, leather jackets and they got their hair done like the 1950s and like they probably are out of place in their home. So they come to feel more at home and see the Elvis statues and stuff. But when they get there, they're also out of place because people are like, why are these, you know, these people don't speak our language. They're like, it's a very like fish out of water thing. But Jarmusch has this great way of just like making it so humane in the way he presents scenes. It's Stranger Than Paradise, which is his first film, is the best example of this, that they almost unfold like books. These scenes kind of lay out 3-4 minutes at a time with no real camera movement. It's all on the dialogue. So it's like reading the page and then he'll flip the page. And so he's kind of a literary filmmaker. And it's very interesting. Again, I mean, he was a guy who was coming from a film school background. And I mean, so was Spike Lee when he comes on and in the mid 80s. He had Scorsese to look up to. Because if you look at us, especially his early films, I mean, Do the Right Thing has so many of Scorsese's little just signatures, visual signatures, with the long takes and those kind of swooping zoom ins. Spike Lee's character is just, he's on the go that whole movie. And it's not unlike Goodfellas the next year. It's a different context, but it's just a slice of life for these guys. And Spike Lee, his first film, the one before that was She's Gotta Have It, I believe, which they just rebooted as a TV show on Netflix a couple years ago. But yeah, it was black and white. It was groundbreaking. That's what Jarmusch's work is. It's this black and white, and it was this very defined aesthetic in this New York scene in the mid-80s. Sometimes you hear it called No Wave. There was some music associated with this too. And it's kind of like this, post-punk thing. And it is surprising that you think Spike Lee would come out of that, but I mean, he does. And
yeah, and he gets to start like his own thing. I mean, he's really the godfather of the Harlem Renaissance, in my opinion. I mean, he really harkens that's what's coming next.
The influences he pulls from, he has a lot of jazz stuff. He goes back to that time when black cultural figures had this power to them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, America didn't let that like kind of go to its, you know, unifying apex. Conclusion. Yeah, it's apex. And so Spike Lee comes along in the 80s. And I mean, Do the Right Thing is it's basically a didactic movie on race relations. He kind of spells it out to you. I mean, the big scene is Spike Lee at the end, whether or not he should throw the trash can through the window. It's a very simple thing, but it's what it represents. And what, you know, there's more than that. There's police violence and there's the racism within the black community. There's racism between the Asian community and the black community there. There's racism between the Italians and the blacks. And like, it's this whole just slice of life one day on this. It's shot on location. It looks like a set. The colors are so beautiful. And if you haven't seen Do the Right Thing, I like the number one movie to just like drop everything, go watch. It'll blow your mind. It made a big uproar at the box office at the time
because people didn't know how to take it. And at the film festival circuit that was really starting to circulate. Because I mean yes. Like, there's actually like a bunch of visual cues in Do the Right Thing. Specifically, like if you watch that movie and then go watch a lot of major films from the 90s, like they literally rip shots from that like they rip shots from Akira. Or like,
oh yeah,
or from like Kurosawa, like
they it becomes just, part like, of the new cinematic language.
Yeah, like this is the new style of the 90s. This is what's in. This is what's hot. But like, really, like Spike Lee's the originator of it.
He is, and it, yeah, everyone goes to Tarantino, but Spike Lee, I mean, he kind of gets his thing kickstarted. I mean,
I think
he, much like Cassavetes was for Scorsese, Scorsese was able to be for him early in his career, and he had a mentor like that, and he's got one of those master classes now, how to make your own independent film, because that he was scrapping. This guy had to make his path because it wasn't there, especially, I mean, he's this like little black guy. Anyone could beat him up in a fight, and he's not going to get the benefit of a lot of doubts in this country, unfortunately. But he made himself, I mean, he's any movie that comes out, everyone's going to see it. He gets courtside seats the last 30 years at Knicks games. I mean, he's a cultural institution, and he made that himself in a world that was not ready to give it to him. And so that's the kind of spirit we also have in the 80s. It's not just these corporate vultures taking over for more Coke money. Like, we have dudes scrapping as well. It's always – you're always going to have that. It's just what the tenor of the 80s was, what kind of scripts were getting looked at and greenlit. That kind of boxes in the spectrum of possibility. And so you need these people to puncture through. You need your Jarmusches. Yeah. You need your Spike Lees. David Lynch is another one of these guys, completely his own lane. Mm-hmm. No one could have gave that to him. He just made his own thing and he gets his start. Yeah. In the 80s.
Yeah. And like, I think it's interesting to look back on what we study from that time, particularly from the 80s, because I think there's a lot of people that grew up in the 80s or were alive in the 80s, that might be listening, that might remember it differently than the people that have the nostalgia for the 80s, that like look at it through the lens of Stranger Things or through like experiencing Dungeons and Dragons for the first time, or like listening to a cyberwave cover of like a song from the original Doom soundtrack.
Reiterations. Where it's always like, bring up here.
Yeah, or we're playing a little retro game on our Switch, like on, you know, the NES. Like that's kind of stuff. When you look at the actual culture of the time, a lot of it was like a lot of rehashing of the same franchises, because this year there has to be another like of this franchise, and it's like this Freddy movie versus this Jason movie at the box office until we finally get to like Freddy versus Jason in the aughts.
Right. Yeah. Where they like, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, like, these guys were literally like at the box office fighting each other in the horror sector, or like in the comedy sector, like it was Eddie Murphy and it was Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray. And like, people were going to see like those films. And a lot of the time they were playing very similar, if not the same characters, or they were part of a franchise or an attempted franchise like Ghostbusters. Like, Ghostbusters 2 bombed. That's why we never got a third one.
Yeah, but...
Like people forget that
it would have.
Yeah, like, City Slickers 2 bombed. It was, like, in the same kind of vein at the time. People thought it was, like, not really... It didn't really warrant a sequel.
Yeah, which, I mean, it probably didn't. And we see it now as, like, if a movie does better than expected, then it's like, well...
Well, now we have to do more. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, well, maybe like, people just liked it for what it was. Who was asking for Uncle Eddie's Island...
Adventure for Christmas
Vacation too.
Yeah, or like when they try to like do their own franchises, like making, because something that would have like all the elements of something like Star Wars, but set in like Detroit today. So we have like Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins.
Okay, yeah.
Where it's literally the Hero of a Thousand Faces story, but with like some American dude, and it's like Roadhousey kind of flavor. we could kind of get like those people that aren't really into sci-fi and aren't really into the whole laser sword magic Jedi thing, and just kind of get them, and like that's literally, and we can put it on VHS, we could do whatever, and then we call it The Adventure Begins, and that sets up the trilogy.
And
like,
and we see all that's these actually cliffhangers, because yeah, you don't,
there's a
you don't
lot
get
of movies that,
with...
that do that. A ton of movies do that.
And yeah, because I think, again, just to reiterate on that, the VHS is important here. It is an innovation in the like the mode of distribution and how people see these movies. And so, I mean, if you were a fan of these 70s lower budget horror films, you would have to go see them at a midnight film festival sometimes.
Yeah.
Or if you knew a friend with a film projector or something. But it's not something you have access to by time. You get to the later 80s and 90s, we have this boom of like, yeah, blockbusters there. You can go, yeah. I mean,
but
you,
that's
you
also
go
what
spend
kinda,
a night there.
That's what kind of like spurs this independent movement, though. It's like all of that franchise stuff. Now we look back on like The Thing or like John Carpenter's original work with a little more reverence. Or we look on to like, we look at David Lynch or Spike Lee. At the time, like Spike Lee was like, came out of nowhere. And it had this pop sensibility to it. But there's plenty of artists around that area, that period of time, that did really get a lot of credit until much, much later. Some of them aren't really getting a ton of credit until, like, recently. In, like, the last, like, 10 years. That's a long time to wait.
There's this film from, I believe it's 87. It's called Ishtar with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman. Elaine May directed it, who made one of my favorite 70s movies, Mikey and Nikki, with John Cassavetes and Peter Falk. But this movie, Ishtar, was kind of, when it was released in 87, as far as I'm aware, it was regarded as something of Heaven's Gate. It was this huge failure. You had these two megastars, Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman. And it was they I forget what the story is, but they go somewhere in the Middle East and they're like a songwriting duo. And I don't really know what the movie's about, but I've recently been seeing all
it
of this. Like,
feels like a cultural appropriation movie.
It's
for you saying
that
Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty, and then the word Ishtar. I'm like, okay, well, I think we're going down a road that might make a lot of people uncomfortable on Twitter.
But I was – well, it interesting because it has now gotten reassessed and people are saying it's actually a great film from the 70s.
Really?
Or from the 80s. Yeah, and I – like – I'm trying to think of another good example, but just with that
ooh,
idea.
What about
that
Mom and Dad Save the World?
Ooh, no. I'd still never heard that one.
No, there's probably, I don't know if there's like really a ton. Like, I'm actually surprised. Like, didn't they try to reboot like Beverly Hills Cop? They tried to reboot some of these other ones and it just didn't work.
And I mean, but like, what good would it be without Eddie Murphy? And it's like, he's still alive. If it's not going to be him doing it, then...
Yeah, but I think it was like the Son of Axel or something.
Yeah, and then, like, they'll end up doing it. And I just... it is what it is. It's just, I feel like with the 80s, there's just, like, this void in a lot of the films where you can just see that they took... they made money decisions, not artistic decisions. And you... Inherently
that was the flavor,
that,
though. That was the flavor of the time, was, like, speculative investing. Like these guys, like, when you see Wolf of Wall Street, like, it's kind of a caricature. It's kind of this, like, romanticized, caricaturized version of what really happened. But that feeling, that energy, that flavor was there in everything in the 80s. So, I do fault the studios for that. I do fault a lot of the money talk for that, because they were looking at, like, you know, how do we not lose money again? It kind of stops the risk. It makes people risk adverse to be looking at that and go, well, where's the money? And then you don't really care what's in the story. You don't really care what's in the movie. You don't really care about these things outside of, like, the elements that you feel are needed to get people in the seats for that particular month. Those aren't the movies that are remembered after years and years and years and years and years. People don't remember Scary Movie 3.
I do.
Then you have not done enough drugs.